You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review for the edition covering the 6th to the 12th of June 2013. My name's Chris Parr and today we have like well-behaved children in a primary school being allowed to take our class outside. How excited. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, deputy news editor John Morgan, reporter Elizabeth Gibney and editor John Gill in Red Lion Square, which is located right outside the Times Higher Education offices. It's not without higher education relevance. Indeed, it was here on this very site in 1974 where a march by the National Front was met by a counter-protest that included Warwick University maths student Kevin Gately, who died that day as a result of injuries sustained during those clashes, aged just 20. The park also contains a bust of Bertrand Russell, the philosopher and Trinity College Cambridge graduate, and indeed a statue of Fenner Brockway, the journalist and anti-war activist. So those two statues making Red Lion Square a very apt setting for both the Times Higher Education's headquarters and indeed this issue review podcast. Today, as ever, we'll be discussing several highlights from the week's edition. The lead news story this week looks at the concept of measuring graduates' earnings according to the university they attended. John Morgan will be talking to us about that. Students' understanding or misunderstanding, should I say, of plagiarism is also on the bill. Also, scholars going hungry to the point of rummaging through supermarket bins will be covered. And John Gill will be mentioning a few things about this week's cover feature, which looks at the working day of an academic. But first up, John Morgan, you've been looking at a piece talking about the measuring of graduates' earnings and sort of tying down which university they went to and how much they earned. Why is this in the news at the moment?
So basically there's a research project to gather data on graduate earnings using the database from the PAYE element of the tax system and student loans company database. And that's taken a major step forward. The data is in place. This project's being led by a University of Oxford economics professor and a University of Cambridge education expert. And this project is being viewed as having enormous significance for the whole sector and for the political parties' policies on higher education funding as well. And basically the significant thing about it is, as well as tracking graduate earnings, it's going to break it down for each university, so you'll be able to see for each university whose graduates go on to earn the best salaries. And the idea is that this could be used as a performance metric for universities, in that you could decide who gets to charge above a certain fee threshold, like £6,000, based on whether the university is doing well enough in terms of its graduate earnings. So the universities that are perceived as doing best on this metric of graduate earnings might be able to charge unlimited fees is one suggestion.
It could also be quite useful though, couldn't it? I mean, if you're trying to calculate how many student loans are going to be repaid, what percentage of student loans will come back long term, this is something the government's always wanted to know. It's a very useful bit of data. Surely sort of that could be quite a beneficial thing to be able to figure out.
Yes, certainly it is to do with this technical area of the RAB charge on student loans, the proportion of the loans that are never repaid. But again, it's breaking that down by each institution. And also with the government still considering plans to sell off the student loan book, it's going to be of real interest to banks who might want to take over the student loans for groups of universities or particularly desirable universities. They'll be able to look at this data that's been gathered and see, you know, which universities are the most attractive, which are the most risky that you might want to avoid. And there's also the other issue of kind of looking at universities' graduate earnings as the basis to judge as to whether it's performing well or not. Does having high earning graduates mean that you're a good university? Is that a fair way to judge any added value that you get from taking your degree at a particular university, or does that just reflect the kind of social status of the students who are coming into the university and how selective that institution is? So there are real concerns about whether or not using this data to judge university performance is the right thing.
Yeah, it's a good question, John.
I think that point about the value added is a good one, because I mean, we're talking on a day when there's been a huge hoo-ha in the media about James Caan from Dragon's Den getting in all sorts of trouble about, you know, saying that kids should be able to make their own way in the world and that parents shouldn't be hiring their children and so on. And yet here we are talking about a system which doesn't actually measure. Well, what does it measure? I mean, I think that's really up for grabs, because it's not looking at necessarily the value that, as John says, the value that's added to a student who might be coming from a poorer background or a more wealthy background or a more socially connected background. So I can see that being a real problem in terms of this being this data being used in any sort of, you know, broad way. And the other thing that we've been discussing a little bit in the newsroom is that this must be, to use the vernacular, universities, certain types of universities must be absolutely bricking it about this information, because whereas at the top of the kind of, you know, the top of the league tables, Cambridge, Oxford and the like, I'm sure that they've got the kind of, you know, very high earning graduates that you would expect, there's probably a huge swathe of universities in the middle where really they've never had this kind of information scrutinised, just because it hasn't been out there. And I really think there could be some big surprises if this data was ever made public, about the kind of graduate earnings premium that you may or may not get at different types of institution.
Yeah, no, I'd back that up as well. Really, this kind of this goes to the heart of one of the biggest sort of elephants in the room, really, when it comes to higher education, and that is, you know, what is the correlation really between a degree and where you do that degree and your earnings, really, and how much has university education added to that? So I think it's it really is a big debate to be had around this, and whether it actually is very useful.
Yeah, indeed, it's a debate that will run and run, but do read John Morgan's piece. It's the main news story this week. Lizzie, you have a couple of articles on plagiarism this week. Firstly, a survey suggesting students aren't even really aware of what constitutes plagiarism at all. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. So this is a study which is called the Impact of Policies for Plagiarism in Higher Education Across Europe. So it's a three-year study, and they've done a survey of almost 5,000 students, and they asked them a huge number of questions, actually. But one of the things which came out that I thought was most interesting was that students really didn't seem to get what plagiarism is. And this wasn't just in countries where they have, you know, very few policies on it. This was in the UK. They compared the situation where students were told that 40% of a submission was copied, and there were no citations, no references, no quotations. Is that plagiarism? And word for word copying, they said yes. But if you said, well, if you change some words, how about then? And suddenly about a third of them went, ooh, we're not sure now.
Put a comma in it.
Exactly, that's the line we took in our headline. I'm no plagiarist, I moved a comma. And this is obviously a great concern, because the big effort at the moment is in terms of education. Maybe students, we can't tell them to stop plagiarising if they don't exactly know what that is. And there are a range of questions asked, and the fact that you know, it might be in the citation, in the reference, or as a quotation, different combinations of that, even though you're still copying 40% of it, totally threw them, and they seemed to have no real idea, in fact, what was plagiarism and what wasn't.
Yeah, very interesting. Simon.
I was just going to say that what I found interesting about this is that it reminded me of my time at university, and how in the first term they're trying to get to grips with referencing in essays that you write, and just remembering that nobody really kind of explained why you should reference, or the importance of it, or how you should do it. You kind of had to just figure it out for yourself, it felt like, a little bit some of the time. So I'm really not kind of surprised by some of the findings in this.
Yeah, Lizzie, you also this week had another feature on plagiarism, just very, very quickly. You spoke to Donald Kornfeld, I understand, a Columbia University psychiatrist who's looking into why people cheat at all. What was sort of the top lines on that?
Well, this was really about misconduct in general and among PhD students as well, but all going all the way up to researchers and professors. And this was his point, was from the psychologist's, you know, psychiatrist even point of view, why do people actually cheat? And what he said was, among the younger, the more early career researchers, it was the fact that they were worried. Their project wasn't going the way they thought it would. They were desperately trying to get papers published or trying to get a position, and therefore they thought, well, you know, how much do I really cause damage if I fudge a few results? So he says we need much more support for them. We need better mentoring. And we need to really blame the institutions as well as the postdoc or the PhD student themselves, because he points out that when you're in that situation, actually, you are part of a system, and that system should take some responsibility as well. At the other end of the spectrum, when you've got these very grandiose, is the word he uses, professors who maybe fudge an enormous number of their papers, and they feel like they can do it because no one's checking up on them. They're so well established in their field that if they do it, no one's going to call them on it. So there are two different aspects of this that we should be looking at, he says. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Some very high-profile papers recently that have been flagged up for plagiarism and mistakes. So I suppose you can get too comfortable. Simon, perhaps we'll come back to you. Another article this week. The park maybe seems quite an apt place to discuss this one. It sounds extreme, but last week at the UCU Congress, we heard how some academics have been driven to go bin diving, I believe is the term, looking through bins for food because they're worried about going hungry. Could you elaborate on that? Well, it sounds like a pretty extreme top line for me.
Well, I wasn't going to kind of introduce this by then going to the nearest bin in the park and seeing what I could find.
Go on.
I mean, there is a serious point here. I mean, and probably this kind of story may have suffered some exaggeration in some ways, just as it's a kind of anecdote, really, about Cardiff University and how a retention officer there told the UCU Congress last week that the popularity of classes on how to look through supermarket bins had kind of there'd been an increase in that popularity among sort of staff, especially those on the kind of zero hours contracts, the kind of contracts where you're not guaranteed a fixed amount of hours every week, and it's casualization of working, really, and you just kind of hope that you will get some hours each week, but it's not guaranteed. And a kind of serious point that's being made is that the increase in these kind of contracts and this kind of working is just means that more and more academic staff are finding that they're struggling to make ends meet. It's as simple as that. So, I think it's quite, and this is it's obviously not a problem that's just confined to higher education. You can find it in other areas of work as well, but there's just increasingly sort of a lot of worry, really, that this kind of might be efficient for managers and efficient for kind of universities to employ people in this way, but that is the kind of human side of it, really.
I think you're absolutely right as well about this not being an issue exclusive to higher education. I think I manage to do this every week somehow and draw parallels between higher education and journalism, but it's something that we've seen in journalism where a lot of national newspapers pretty much only entirely staffed by people with effectively 0 hour contracts, people doing shift work, and there's all sorts of ramifications for that. It's not just that it's thoroughly unpleasant for the individuals involved, lack of job security, lack of pensions, lack of holidays. It's also potentially very damaging in terms of social mix of staff you get, because you reach a situation where in journalism at least people can only really afford to do it or sort of make the break, especially in London, if they have somebody else supporting them, whether it's a parent or a partner who's got another job and earning a regular salary. So it's a big deal, and certainly in the States I know there's been all sorts of for years there's been real worry about the casualisation of the workforce. So it's something that's kind of crossing the Atlantic to a certain extent as well.
And of course, our cover feature this week covers on some of the conditions and working hours of academics across the board. Perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit more about what's in there.
Yeah, this is our cover feature is actually written by, I think, six different people working in universities. So we have a vice chancellor, a science professor, a registrar, an early career researcher, and the head of a graduate school. Is that five? And they're actually giving us a kind of breakdown of their working day. And it's really interesting to see the similarities and also the differences in people sort of in different roles and different types of university perhaps as well, and their attitudes towards the working day and how many hours they should be putting in and overtime, unpaid overtime and all the rest of it. I mean, it does come across when you read these accounts as an incredibly hard-working profession. This is not a 9-to-5 job in any shape or form wherever you are in a university, and that really comes through. You've got kind of the postdoc talking about their day beginning at 6 in the morning and finishing kind of well into the evening. She describes her office. She says her office is her bedroom. So the kind of the working conditions. And then you've got, obviously, by contrast, the vice chancellor, who talks a bit about about not having a particularly glamorous executive office, but having a wonderful view of this sort of award winning glass and steel building they've just built outside of her window. So you've got the differences there. But you also have some very interesting similarities. You've got things like the tyranny of email, which again, not exclusive to higher education, but the way people feel absolutely tied to their desk and kind of tied down by email, and the way that really disrupts their creativity and their ability to go out and actually do, think and do their jobs to a certain extent. And then you've also got some great little anecdotes. We've got the Professor Philip Moriarty, who's a physicist at Nottingham, talking in a very, you might say, gung-ho fashion about his own attitude to some of the initiatives at his university. He actually says that some of the kind of more bureaucratic stuff that happens in his job is some of the most patronising and poorly written junk I've ever had the misfortune to read. So he's not pulling his punches. And I think it just gives a bit of a reflection of quite how much effort and energy and work goes into all aspects of university life.
Yeah, no, it's well worth a read. And I should point out, after that appraisal of a piece looking at the long working hours, that we don't always sit in the park to record these podcasts. I assure you, if we weren't here, we'd be inside in the studio. But it seemed too nice a day to miss. You can discuss all the stories that you've heard today on our Facebook page, on our Google Plus page, on LinkedIn. You'll get us on Twitter. I should also flag up the two interviews I did with Vince Cable and Boris Johnson this week. They're in their own podcast, which you'll find in the usual places on our site and on iTunes. I should also remind listeners that we have a books podcast online too. It's the latest in our series. Books editor Karen Shook in conversation with Bert Beck's Joanna Bork, and thoroughly gripping that is too. But until next week, thanks to Simon, John and Lizzie. Do get in touch via whatever means you wish. TimesHigherEducation.co.uk is a great place to start, and we'll see you for another podcast next week.
Yeah, so you're going to find that beer garden now, Chris.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.